Good morning. I don't know exactly which holiday greeting to give. There's sort of a holiday traffic jam today. We had Thanksgiving, Hanukkah, and of course now Christmas is really roaring on strong now that it's December. There's a lot to cover. I have to cover a lot of spirit in this one sermon. I guess this is sort of my Thanksgiving-a-Charismas sermon. Christmas was a relatively minor holiday for almost 1,000 years in the Christian calendar. Easter was far more important. But if you look at the New Testament, it's not difficult to find the basic elements of the Christmas that we know today. There are no Christmas trees, ribbons, wrappings, or reindeer, but you will find presents and even a sort of a Grinch. This is from the Gospel of Matthew. Now when Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea in the days of Herod the king, behold, magi from the east, who might have been sorcerers, astrologers, or some even say mathematicians, came to Jerusalem, saying, "Where is he who has been born king of the Jews? For we've seen his star in the east and have come to worship him." Now Herod was confused. He'd been pretty certain that he was the king of the Jews. So he consults with his own wise men, priests and scribes who are more into literature than math or stars. They check with their old scrolls and discover that indeed there is an old prophecy about a major ruler rising from the minor town of Bethlehem. Then Herod summoned the wise men secretly, and he sent them to Bethlehem, saying, "Go and search diligently for the child, and when you found him, bring me word that I too may come and worship him." Old Herod is so smart and so slick that he thinks up that lie of his awfully quick. Later, he'll show himself to be even more wicked than the Grinch when he tries to steal Christmas by killing all the baby boys born recently in the neighborhood. But for now, here are the presents brought from even further than Mount Crumpet. When they heard the king, the magi went their way, and lo, the star which they'd seen in the east went before them till it came to rest over the place where the child was. When they saw the star, they rejoiced exceedingly with great joy, and going into the house, they saw the child with Mary, his mother, and fell down and worshipped him. Then, opening their treasures, they offered him gifts, gold and frankincense, and myrrh. Babies just love these things, especially myrrh. So Christmas is off to a good start, even if it takes 1,000 more years to become a major church and family holiday. Likewise, Hanukkah was for centuries a very minor celebration in the Jewish ritual year compared to major holidays like Passover and Yom Kippur. It has also grown in recent times into an important celebration of Jewish identity and a fun time for kids of all ages. Like the Christmas stories that I've just read, though, it has a dark side, as well as those lights shining through in the distance. In a few moments, I'll share a bit of both with you, both the light and the dark. For now, let's sing Hymn number 347, Gather the Spirit. 347. Thank you. My hands were already a little tired from holding the children's book. This is another one of those where we have to flip, but it seems like you could plan your book so you don't have to do that. But maybe the next time. We're about ready for a new hymn. It's about time. About every 25 years or so. Well, someone once asked a rabbi, "Rabbi, please tell me, why do rabbis always seem to answer a question with a question?" To which the rabbi replied, "And why should a rabbi not answer a question with a question?" The Hanukkah story that most of us have heard, and the one that's most fun to share with children, is one that does not come from the Bible. Rather, it comes from the Babylonian Talmud, a collection of religious and civil law gathered by the rabbis of the 5th century of the Common Era and presented in a constant back and forth of questions, answers, and then more questions. So it should be no surprise that the story of Hanukkah also begins with a question. What is Hanukkah? The rabbis taught, on the 25th day of Kislev, Hanukkah commences and lasts 8 days, on which lamenting in commemoration of the dead and fasting are prohibited. When the Hellenists entered the sanctuary, they defiled all the oil that was found there. When the government of the house of Asmoneans prevailed and conquered them, oil was sought to feed the holy lamp in the sanctuary, and only one vial was found with the seal of the high priest intact. The vial contained sufficient oil for 1 day only, but a miracle occurred, and it fed the holy lamp 8 days in succession. These 8 days were the following year established as days of good cheer, on which psalms of praise and acknowledgement of God's wonders were to be recited. Now, I wouldn't be surprised if this passage leaves you with some questions. One question might be about the time. When is the month of Kislev? If you look it up in the dictionary, you'll find it listed as both the third month of the civil year and the ninth month of the religious year in the Jewish calendar, which may leave you with still more questions. Ninth or third? Which one is it? But there seems to be little question about the spirit of the time in question. There's to be no mourning for the dead during Hanukkah. If we remember our dead, and who can forget them, especially during the holidays? We should remember them joyfully. The toast to Frank, to Betty, Eleanor, Rob, Audrey and Raphael, Richard Henderson, all people we've lost in the last 9 years. But joyfully, there should be no lamentation and no fasting. We should eat and enjoy our food. Foods prepared with oil in memory of the temple oil. Oily things like potato latkes. Yes, they're fattening, but relax a little, say the rabbis. These days are mandated to be days of good cheer. So for once, the law actually seems to prescribe that we have some fun. There's a strong element of play in Hanukkah. What's not to enjoy in lighting one more candle each evening 8 times in a row? Actually, we find in the Talmud that, surprise, some rabbis had some serious questions about how the candles should be handled. Rabbi Shammai taught that all of the candles should be lit on the first night, then their number should be reduced each night thereafter. Rabbi Hillel, who's famous for the saying, if I'm not for myself, who will be for me? And when I am for myself, what am I? And if not now, when? That Hillel argued that we should start with one candle, then add one each night until they're all lit. The rabbis reached a compromise: to follow the practice of Hillel until the Messiah comes, and then follow the practice of Shammai. Our menorah is arranged Hillel style for now. Messiah or no Messiah, the rabbis were unanimous that we should do no work with the candles and also do no work by their light. So what should we do? One of the things we should do is something that the rabbis usually said we shouldn't. We should gamble a little for fun, for nuts or raisins maybe, or maybe a little money. Either real coins or later on coins made of chocolate. For fun and with a dreidel, which is kind of a goofy square-sided top. I forgot my dreidel. I wanted to bring you one. Each side is inscribed with letters that stand for the Hebrew words Nes Gadol Hayasham. A great miracle happened there. In Israel today, some dreidels substitute one of the letters so it stands for Nes Gadol Hayah Po, a great miracle happened here. Here or there, dreidels point to the miracle of the oil that burned for 8 days when there should have only been enough for one. And it's this miraculous sufficiency that the rabbis want us to take to heart. Oil for one day, burn for eight. Amazing! There's a special joy in such an experience that's different from the confidence that comes from having something like a full warehouse, a full bank account, a full tank of gas for a fairly short trip. One of my favorite episodes of Seinfeld, do you all know Seinfeld? Okay. It has Kramer. You all know Kramer? Shopping for a car when he has no real intention to buy one. He just wants to drive it around. He starts a conversation with the salesman who accompanies him on a test drive and shares his observation that there always seems to be some gas in the tank, even when it shows empty. And the salesman is intrigued. They keep driving until the needle almost bottoms out, a bond growing between them as they take this goofy gamble together. If you know your Seinfelds and can picture Kramer, you can imagine his goofy, square-sided face as he plunges into this goofy endeavor. As they approach the highway exit that would take them back to the auto dealership, Kramer says something to the effect of, "What if we just keep going?" With moist eyes, they take each other's hands. And reenacting the final scene of in Thelma and Louise, when Gina Davis and Susan Sarandon roar straight over a cliff with the police in pursuit, they just zoom past the exit, running on fumes into the great beyond. I hope I haven't zoomed right past you with too many pop culture references, but my point is to share what the rabbis say is the heart of Hanukkah, the joy of unexpected, almost miraculous sufficiency. It's something that we might feel around any holiday or at any other time, really. The feeling that this is enough. There is enough within me. And yes, beside me, right here, right now, to let me go the whole way, as preposterous as this might seem. This little bit of fuel, this neighbor's hand filled with nothing but my hand, and a bit of human warmth. Nothing more is required, except that I affirm it from the bottom of my heart. When this happens for a family or a community, then it's time for some singing down here in Whoville, and some fried food. And some chocolate. So I guess I've answered the rabbi's question, what is Hanukkah? Not quite. We've enjoyed the story of the wonderful oil, but we haven't considered the larger story of which it's a part. Go back to what the rabbi said. When the Hellenists entered the sanctuary, they defiled all the oil that was found there. When the government of the house of Asmoneans prevailed and conquered them, oil was sought to feed the holy lamp, and only one vial was found with the seal of the high priest, still intact. So who are these Hellenists, and what is the house of Asmoneans? The Hellenists here are Greek-speaking Syrians of the 2nd century before the Common Era. These Greco-Syrians had conquered much of Israel and taken control of the temple in Jerusalem. That's where the oil was and the lamp. And now we finally come to the part of the Hanukkah story that is found in the Bible, sort of. It's found in some Bibles, in the first and second books of Maccabees, which is another name for the Asmoneans. And I hope you're not confused now, because it's going to get worse. Neither book is found in the Hebrew Bible. They were written in Greek, which was the language of most Jews at the time, just as it was for Syrians. So you have to get the picture. When they cussed each other out, both sides had to do it in Greek. Oh, that's good. You can understand each other. And there was a lot to cuss about. When the Syrians took the temple, they're said to have stolen all of its treasures, all the silver and gold, the temple menorah, They also began to sacrifice on its altar to their own gods, who seemed to have favored the blood of pigs, considered unclean animals by the Jews. As we've heard already, they also stole the jars of sacred olive oil. The story tells us that some Jews accepted this new state of affairs. They stopped circumcising their sons, just as they'd been ordered. Babies like that even better than they like myrrh, by the way. Some of them even began to participate in the new ruler's sacrifices. Others resisted, and many were put to death. Still others managed to escape, and they began to plot a revolution. One Mattathias, the son of a Judean priest, along with his sons, began to rebel openly against this Greco-Syrian authority. They started by publicly tearing their clothes and putting on sackcloth. Back then, no less than today, public acts of mourning often serve as a staging ground for more violent acts of protest. These began, the more violent acts, when Mattathias gives, quote, vent to righteous anger, as the book calls it, and kills, who? A fellow Jew who had participated in pagan rites. Attacking those of our own who seem to collaborate with the enemy before we dared attack the actual enemy is also nothing new. Just check the news from Syria today or many other places. Mattathias and his sons now take to the hills and start making raids to attack other collaborators. They forcibly circumcise all uncircumcised males, whether Jew or Gentile, who they catch within the borders of Israel. You say, amen or ouch. And then they do battle with the Syrians. When Mattathias dies, he passes command to his son Judas, who is also called Maccabeus, or Hammer. Judas takes the battle forcibly to the Syrians, or the Gentiles, as the book calls them, and with his forces manages to retake the temple. What next? Good question. They purified the temple. This is from the book of Maccabees. Removing to an unclean place the stones which defiled it. They discussed what to do with the altar of burnt offering, which was profaned, and rightly decided to demolish it, for fear it might become a standing reproach to them because it had been defiled by the Gentiles. They pulled down the altar and stored away the stones in a fitting place on the temple hill until a prophet should arise who could be consulted about them. They took unhewn stones, as the law commands, and built a new altar on the model of the previous one. So here's where the rabbis begin the story about the miraculous container that fed the lamp for 8 days with oil that should only have been enough for one. The book of Maccabees itself says nothing about the oil. Rather, it goes on to tell us about the Syrian counterattack and all the battles that follow. It's really a war book. It also tells us that Judas the Hammer continued to, quote, purge Israel of other remnants of Syrian religion while also pounding down those Jews who he felt had betrayed their faith. He meets with such success in these campaigns that he decides to go one step further, past the exit like Kramer. Judas turned aside to the land of the Philistines. He tore down their altars and the graven images of their gods. He burned with fire. He plundered the cities and returned to the land of Judah. What the story fails to mention is that the Philistines of this time were at peace with Israel. They were just good neighbors sitting quietly at home when Judas Maccabeus came to call. It's one thing when the fire of spirit burns longer and carries us farther than we ever expected to go. When the oil for one night lasts for 8. That's something to celebrate with bright lights and singing. It's quite another thing when the fire of our spirit spreads to other people's homes, when the knock on the door comes like a hammer. What to call that is a very good question indeed. One thing I wouldn't call it is a holiday. Does it sound like something that you could celebrate? Let me answer this question with the rabbi's question. about the candles. Should we light a new one every evening until the menorah is all aglow? Or should we start with all eight burning and blow one out each night until it's all gone dark? People like us, by which I mean liberals, by which I also mean your youths, by which I mean people in this very church, to answer my question about who I mean by us, people like us, when it comes to religious enthusiasm, are more inclined toward blowing candles out. We've seen the devastation of too much religious fire, and it scares us. But then, we tend to go too far in the opposite direction from the Maccabees. We make it more and more difficult to light even one candle and take joy in that. I don't want to hear this word or that one. Don't sing that song, or don't sing too long. Don't embarrass me with too much feeling. We withdraw from one worshipful activity from another until the next natural step is to withdraw from worship altogether and from attending worship services. One more candle goes out. Those who remain feel the darkness closing in and wonder what is wrong. Should we stop coming too? Please take a moment now to pause and close your eyes. Feel the energy in your body, your mind, the whole of your being. Stay there for a moment. Is there something there? Is there something really there? How was it? Just that simple exercise. We are so much more than the words we speak, the work we do, the property that we accumulate and care for. I hope that you felt that just now. Your presence is something real. There's an energy. There's a power. It's very personal, yes, but it's also something that can be shared. It can also be taken elsewhere or even withheld. That's your candle. What are you going to do with it? Light it? Nurture it? Or blow it out? Our fourth religious principle is acceptance of one another and encouragement to spiritual growth in our congregations. In our congregations. Not just at home, not just in private. Congregating is the very core of our religious practice. When we don't come together, or if too many of us just don't bother, the light we share as a congregation may seem like it's failing. Others feel discouraged. Where is everybody? What's wrong? But when many gather, as many do once a year at our alternative gifts fair, and please come to that, you won't believe the energy in the room, the hundreds of people, the fresh air, the people coming through and trailing their spirits with them, bringing in the cold air from the outside. When that happens, we feel enlivened, energized, charged up. Imagine a Sunday with such full attendance. And then imagine, why not every Sunday? Remember the Grinch. He has withheld himself from Who's society for 53 years. Now, who wouldn't want a break from the Who's now and then? I get that. I was told at the motel when I came in that they'd been full on Friday. All the people who'd come to stay with their family for the Thanksgiving weekend, and about Friday came, and they said, okay, I've had enough of the Who's for now, I'm going to a motel. I get it. But in the end, he learns that the holiday is so much more than its trappings. The most important thing he can bring to the celebration is what? Do you remember? It's himself. It's himself. Down from Mount Crumpet and into the feast he comes at last to the congregation where he, the Grinch himself, carves the roast beast. Sharing his living presence is enough. It's enough and more than enough. It's the essential thing, almost miraculously sufficient. May such miraculous sufficiency fill you and surround you and keep you through the coming year. And may you keep coming here to share it with us as often as you really can. Light one candle, blow it out, then light two next time. Bring your friends whenever you can, no matter who. Tell them that we get to play with fire here. Real spiritual fire. But we're always very careful with it. Happy Thanksgiving Christmas to you, and 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 Cindy Lou too. Amen.